Dr. David Kessler, a former commissioner at the Food and Drug Administration, has been fighting health-related battles for years. He made headlines when he took on big tobacco. More recently, he decided to tackle another problem, but this one had a personal dimension for him. He was on the show back in April to discuss his book, The End of Overeating, Taking Control of the Insatiable American Appetite, and we're going to re-air that interview for you now. I began by asking him whether obesity was a major public policy concern for him when he ran the Food and Drug Administration from 1990 to 1997.
It wasn't front burner the way it is today. In fact, if you look at the increase, you know, back 10 years ago, there were about 4 cases per 1,000 of type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes really is synonymous with obesity. Today, that number has doubled from 4 cases per 1,000 to 9 cases per 1,000. So it really has been a major increase. We did do a lot of work on the food label, but it was not the kind of epidemic that we see today.
What percentage of the country is obese these nowadays?
If you look at both obese and overweight, about two-thirds of us fall into that category.
So when do we stop being overweight and start being obese? I mean, I could be overweight because I'm 5 pounds heavier than my ideal weight, but I'm far from obese.
The scientific, the medical terminology is based on body mass index. So it's not just our weight, it's our weight for height. And between 25 and 30, a BMI is technically overweight. Above 30, it begins obese.
Mm-hmm. And have scientists explained how people gain or lose weight?
That's what I set out to try to understand. You know, one night I was watching the Oprah show, and there was a woman on it. Her name was Sarah, and I was just mesmerized because she's on the set, and she says, "I eat when my husband leaves in the morning. I eat before he comes home at night. I eat when I'm happy. I eat when I'm sad." And then the tears started coming to her eyes. And she said, "I don't like myself." And I was sitting there and trying to listen as a doctor and ask the question, you know, what was going on with this woman? Here she's successful in all aspects of her life, highly educated, well-dressed. Why was she doing things that she didn't want to be doing? And that got me thinking, you know, what's going on with us?
It sounded like she was self-medicating.
Well, what does that mean?
Is that too simple an answer?
What does that mean?
Well, she was, whenever she was feeling down or whatever, or whenever she felt she needed something, food became the thing she turned to.
Well, how does that work? She also said when she's happy, she ate to celebrate. Mm-hmm. And what we have come to understand is for millions of Americans, and it's interesting, not just people who are obese or overweight, but they have symptoms of what I call conditioned hypereating, where the eating behavior becomes both conditioned and driven. Let me give you 3 characteristics where you ask people, right? Do you have a sense of loss of control in the face of highly palatable foods? Do you have a lack of satiation, a lack of feeling full when you're eating? And do you have a preoccupation with thinking about foods between meals? Those 3 characteristics. And what we find is certainly people who are overweight and obese, more of them self-report those 3 characteristics. But it's not just people who are overweight or obese who have this conditioned hypereating. And that it was also very interesting. I mean, they're healthy weight, but they're living with this sort of torment, or they've taught themselves how to control that kind of behavior. But what we see is if you do the neural imaging of these people, their brain gets activated by cues, by food. And what happens is their brain neural circuitry doesn't shut off. And that's why it's so hard for them to stop eating.
But you said that they're attracted to highly palatable foods. What do you mean by that?
Highly palatable foods are the foods we come back to eat more and more. Now, at the core, they tend to be foods that are high in the trifecta, sugar, fat, and salt.
And you say they affect what you call the settling point.
The settling point is, you know, where do we, each of us, you know, end up at our weight? Scientists used to think there was a biological set point, right? That it was sort of predetermined how much we're going to weigh. And if the reason diets didn't work was that we would lose weight, but we go back to the set point. We understand that today there is really no set point, that it really is how our brains respond to food that determines in large part how much we're going to weigh.
But it changes over a lifetime. Most of my early life, I was very thin, and then I quit smoking, and I put on a lot of weight, and then I got too heavy, and then I don't exactly know how, but I lost weight. I didn't go on a diet or anything, but maybe I got sick or something. There's that joke in one of the movies, I'm just one stomach flu away from my ideal weight. But now I seem to be at another weight level, and that pretty much, I go five above, five below, but it's pretty much that.
Well, let's spend a couple of minutes trying to figure that out. Let me give you the biology of this. We're all wired to focus on the most salient stimuli in our environment. What do I mean? If a bear walked into this studio right now, right, you would stop asking me questions, and you would head out of this studio. That bear is the most salient stimuli. If your kid is sick this morning, you're going to be thinking about your kid. Now, for many of us, right, food has become the most salient stimuli, one of the most salient stimuli. But for others, it could be tobacco, it could be alcohol, it could be gambling, it could be sex, or it could be food. Food is these are all rewards. The most effective rewards are rewards that change how we feel. And certainly we know about those foods, you know, sugar, fat, and salt, they're most reinforcing. So you said, you know, you stopped smoking and you then started eating more and gaining weight. So did you just switch substitute rewards? Is that what happened?
Well, then I quit smoking at a certain point. Well, I mean, then after a while, the quitting smoking no longer was an issue, but I never really, and I don't think that I was overeating, but I never got below. I want to bring you into this in just a moment because you also talk about your struggles with weight. Maybe you have certain insights that, because you've written this book, that I haven't been able to attain. My guest is David A. Kessler, who was a commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration under both George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton. He's a pediatrician, has been the dean of the medical schools at Yale and the University of California, San Francisco. And his latest book is called The End of Overeating, Taking Control of the Insatiable American Appetite, published by Rodale. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. You don't look like you have had weight problems, but you write about your struggles with your weight.
I have suits in every size. I've gained and lost my body weight several times.
Should I be surprised that someone who's dealt a lot with public health issues would have a problem like that?
No, I don't think none of us are immune from the stimuli in our environment. I mean, in some ways, the metaphor for this book was, you know, why does that chocolate chip cookie, you know, that's sitting there, You bring in a plate of, you know, hot, warm chocolate chip cookies, the chunks. You know, why do those chocolate chip cookies have such power over me? You know, and in some ways, the power of food comes from our ability to anticipate it. That anticipation of reward, those cues. I was walking down Powell Street in San Francisco, and all of a sudden, I started thinking about chocolate-covered pretzels. Why chocolate covered pretzels. Well, then I realized I was on that street 6 months earlier, and I had gone into one of the stores and, in fact, bought a chocolate-covered pretzels. So that street, that location, had become a cue. And that cue sets off an anticipation. It captures our attention. There's arousal. And then we consume that food. Every time I land at the airport in San Francisco, just as soon as the plane touches down, I start thinking about Chinese dumplings. Why? Because there's this food court. So just the plane just lands, and I automatically, in my working memory, those dumplings, you know, take over. And if I could just make it to baggage claim, right, if I could just get it, you know, avoid that queue. But think of the next time you're hungry. Think next time you go reach for food. There's always a cue. It could be sight. It could be smell. It could be location. It could be time of day. Sometimes just getting into your car, the car itself can be a cue.
You use the term conditioned hypereaters. Now, there's a difference between eating those dumplings and eating those dumplings to excess.
What we see with the neural activation is not only is there excessive activation during that anticipatory stage, but for those who have, for the millions of Americans who have conditioned hypereating, that stimulation continues, and until the food is gone, it's off your plate, you stay stimulated. So it's very hard to stop.
So we wind up being habitual about food?
Certainly, habit is a very much of a part of this cycle of, you know, we get cued. Those cues capture our attention. We're aroused. We eat. And then we get cued again. So that starts the habit. What's important is the behavior is not only conditioned. It's conditioned and driven. And that's why it's motivated. And that's why I want it. And once you get cued and that ability to capture your attention, that's that stimulus, you say, all right, you start with the internal dialogue, boy, that's going to taste good. No, I shouldn't have that. And when you have that internal dialogue, that only increases the reward value. That only increases, you know, your wanting. My sister-in-law, you know, appropriately said, please, David, you know, don't write a book that only increases our obsession. But that's the nature of reward. Once you get cued, once it captures your attention, when you try to stop, it's very hard because you're in this cycle.
Do you believe that the food industry is deliberately designing food that makes us want to overeat?
I believe the food industry designs food to be highly salient stimuli.
By putting that sugar, salt, and fat in it? Or is it the fact that if you make a chocolate chip cookie, you know that people are going to want to eat it?
I think they've figured out the bliss point. I don't think they've known the neuroscience, but I think they've that bliss point, that optimal level of pleasure, and that locks into our brains. What I think happened was that the food industry figured this out experientially. They knew where the lines were. They knew when people kept on coming back for more. They certainly have layered and loaded our food with this trifecta of sugar, fat, and salt.
You compare some food to drugs. So are we talking about something that is addictive in some people? Have there been MRI studies about people when they're feeling hungry, similar to the sorts of things that we've seen with drug abusers?
I want to be careful here, but in fact, there are commonalities in those pathways. And the activated neural circuits that I talked about in conditioned hypereating are the same activated pathways we see when it comes to whether it's drugs or alcohol or gambling. Those are the reward pathways of the brain. So there are commonalities. Now, what's interesting in the science I've done with some of my colleagues show that when you make food, you layer and load fat, sugar, and salt, you see activation that doesn't shut off. It's sustained stimulation. And that's what you see with drugs. Food, we believe that food, we habituate. You have a bite, it tastes good. but then you don't have this continued activation. But now with this very highly palatable foods, what we're seeing on this kind of the neuroscience shows that the activation stays sustained.
You're right that the food industry is manipulating the American public to overeat in the same way that the tobacco industry manipulated us to smoke.
Understand that 50 years ago, confronted with evidence that smoking caused cancer, the tobacco industry decided to deny that and deceive the American public. Today, we now have the evidence that food that's layered and loaded with fat, sugar, and salt has the ability to stimulate our neural circuits, and for millions of Americans to excessively activate those circuitries to get us to keep on eating. So the question I have is, you know, not what did the food industry know prior to this, but what are we going to do now that we have that science?
Have you spoken to people in the food industry about your concerns?
I have.
And what do they say to you? We don't do it.
No, it's very interesting. I've gone and I've showed some in the industry the science. You know, I said, look, fat, sugar, and salt are salient stimuli. They were wired to focus on the most salient stimuli. And I said to them, I did a comparison. I said, take nicotine. Nicotine is only a moderately reinforcing substance. But add to that nicotine the smoke, the throat scratch, the cellophane crinkling of the pack, the color of the pack, the location of when you smoke, the image of the cowboy, and what do you end up with? You end up with a highly addictive product. I give you a pack of sugar and say, go have a good time, and you're going to look at me, what are you talking about? I add to that sugar fat. I add texture. I add color. I add mouthfeel.
We have a donut.
I put it on every corner. I make it socially acceptable. I say you're going to be able to do it with your friends and have a good time. What do you end up with? You end up with one of the, you know, greatest public health concerns that we're facing today. Look at the French. The French always ate highly palatable foods. But what's the difference? Because they never, until recently, had this problem with obesity. They had certain barriers. Yes, they would eat, very good-tasting foods, but you never saw them walking down the street eating. They never ate between meals. That wasn't socially acceptable. So what did we eat? What's the difference in our country, right, is that we've taken down those barriers. We now put sugar, fat, and salt on every corner. We make it socially acceptable to eat all the time. And we just end up with a much greater public health risk.
My guest is David A. Kessler, whose latest book is The End of Overeating, Taking Control of the Insatiable American Appetite. It is published by Rodale. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with an interview I did in April with Dr. David A. Kessler, who served as commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration under Presidents George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton. He was here to discuss his latest book, The End of Overeating, Taking Control of the Insatiable American Appetite, and we are re-airing that interview for you today. I brought up an argument that I'd heard many people make, that one of the reasons we're seeing so much obesity is that most Americans don't walk as much as they do in cities like New York or San Francisco, and that we're more likely to see obesity in areas where there's little public transportation. I asked him if he sees some kind of relationship between the two.
Certainly exercise is very important. But the fact is, if I give you a candy bar, 500 calories, let's say, how long would it take you to eat it? You know, a couple of minutes. How long would it take to burn off those that same 500 calories that you just consumed in a couple of minutes, that candy bar, it would take you, you know, an hour or so. So the fact is that by loading and layering fat and sugar and salt, by making the food incredibly energy dense, there's no, you know, the equation is just out of whack. So what we know is that the majority of obesity is certainly the result of overconsumption.
A listener wants to know if carbs are also addictive.
Again, let's be careful with the use of the word addiction.
Okay, whatever the words. The carbs make food more palatable. The way you're talking about salt, sugar, and fat.
Well, sugar is a carb. Right? It's the refined carbs. It's very stimulating. The industry had always said, you know, we're just giving consumers, you know, what they want. But in fact, sugar, which is the refined carbohydrate, is stimulating our taste. We always knew that. But it's also stimulating the neurons, and it's activating circuitry in our brain. So the answer is yes, certain types of carbohydrates can be very stimulating.
You mentioned earlier all of those places on the corner, obviously fast food places. Are some more egregious than others? And now do you think things will change when in some places like New York where they're forced to list the amount of calories in what they're selling?
I think that we have seen, you know, food increasingly, certainly in restaurant food, be just layered and loaded with fat, sugar, and salt. I mean, pick any appetizer. Pick, you know, spinach dip, right? What is it? You look at it, it's a misnomer. I mean, you see spinach, you think, hey, that's good for me, but it's fat and salt with some green stuff. Even the average salad that we're eating, what's layered on top? Cheese, bacon, croutons. So you got fat on fat on fat with, you know, a little lettuce. So I think we're seeing this fat and sugar and salt just constantly stimulating us. You know, we're eating for stimulation. We're not eating for nutrition.
So you're not willing to say it's McDonald's or Burger King or whatever. I mean, are they – would you put the same kind of responsibility on them that you would have on the cigarette companies?
I think it's different. But understand, it's not just fast food. You know, in fact, you know, you want to go have a quarter pounder that's 400 or 500 calories for lunch or dinner, that's fine. It's only when you start layering on the bacon, the cheese, the sauce, that's where it becomes highly stimulating.
Do we spend a higher percentage of our income on food than people in other countries?
We certainly spend a good deal on food. But in fact, fat, sugar, and salt, the commercial industrialization makes that sometimes the cheapest food around.
And now with this economic downturn and all the talk about people going to fast food chains and the like to save money, you expect the situation to get worse?
Again, it depends what consumers want. If you look at that large, you know, portion of fries and you say, boy, that looks great. That's going to make me feel better. That's my friend. Right? You know, that's – every time you eat that, you're going to want to eat it again. I've gotten to the point where I want food that tastes good. It's important that food tastes good, that it's rewarding. But I look at these huge portions and I say, boy, that's not what I want. That's not going to make me feel good afterward. That is disgusting.
A couple of books were published recently which suggested that to avoid overweight problems in children, to get them to eat better, you disguise foods. You stick the good stuff into the things that they would want to eat. Do you see that as a good approach?
Well, I'm very concerned.
Because you're a pediatrician.
Yeah, I'm very concerned about children. The fact is, children ages 2, 3, and 4, they used to compensate for they're eating, which means that if I give you more calories, you know, at one meal you'll eat, they'll eat less. So they regulated themselves depending on how many calories they have. But you give them sugar, fat, and salt, they stop compensating. So you have children whose ages 3, 4, 5, they don't stop eating throughout the day. They've never been hungry in their lives. And in fact, if you give them excess sugar, fat, and salt, they will lay down the neural circuitry that will stay with them a lifetime. So what's important is, for, you know, if the greatest gift you can give somebody is having them not lay down that that neural circuitry in the first place.
Well, they put sugar in baby formula, don't they? And wasn't there a lot of pressure on the baby food companies to take some of the salt out of that product?
It only increases the stimulation, and if you start early and you encode that wanting is very hard to change. The only way you can do that is to lay down new learning, and we all know how hard that is.
We have we've been talking a lot about child obesity as a growing problem in this country. Who's responsible? Is it the parents, as you say, who give their kids food when they demand it?
It's a very important key question. Yes, parents have responsibility and as role models, and they're the gatekeepers to the food. But it's not a matter of willpower. You live in an environment, you get bombarded on every corner with fat, sugar, and salt. Once that neural circuitry gets laid down, your brain gets hijacked, and it gets hijacked for life. And you get into this cycle, right, that every time you get cued, your attention gets captured, those neural circuits activate. And the goal is, if you can, for a child, not to lay down that neural circuitry, not to give them this constant exposure to sugar, fat, and salt. I mean, that's the greatest gift you can give a child, because once it's laid down, you know, you have this struggle, and sometimes this struggle for a lifetime.
You've included a chapter about weight loss drugs. Do you think that weight loss drugs are useful?
I don't think they are useful, and I don't think they will ever be very effective. Once you understand that the reason we're gaining weight, the reason we're overeating, is because our brain is getting stimulated, and it's the learning, memory, and habit circuits. You know, it's not circuits. There aren't circuits just for food. There's circuits that affect learning, memory, and habit, and you can't be selective, so there's always going to be side effects that are going to concern me greatly.
You left the FDA a few months before it called for the removal of fen-phen from store shelves. What does fen-phen teach us about weight loss drugs?
It does show, and fen-phen really is amphetamine, that fen-phen worked on the reward pathways, and it quieted those pathways. It had major side effects, major adverse reactions. But scientifically, it's a window into what could work and how this food affects. We know it's the reward pathways. We know that's what fen-phen acted on.
A listener from North Brunswick says that she lost 48 pounds in less than 2 years by basically eating stuff she doesn't like.
The real question is, how can she keep it off? Diets don't work. Why don't they work? Because if you deprive yourself, first, you're just going to increase the reward value of food. But let's say you lose that 40 pounds, and that's great. It's very healthy. But if you don't change the neural circuitry, if you don't change that old learning, I just put you back in that same environment, and you continue to be cued again, of course you're going to gain it back.
Well, how did you break the cycle of overeating for yourself?
Once you understand that it's stimulation, right, and that our brains are being stimulated, then the goal is to reduce that stimulation or to cool off that stimulation. Now, what are the ways we could do that? First, you can avoid, if I'm stimulated, you know, when the food is placed in front of me, I just don't, you know, I say, take it away. Take away that breadbasket, or I avoid being primed. If I put something in my mouth and it primes me, once I start, I don't stop. But that's not very realistic in this kind of environment because I'm constantly being bombarded with cues. If you can eat in a structured environment, if you can avoid this chaotic responding every instant to food, if you eat at certain times, if you plan what you eat, that helps. But in the end, if you look at certain foods and think, that's my friend, that's going to make me feel better, there's little I can do. It's really changing how you perceive the food that is key.
It's odd to me that when I was a kid, there were all those cliches where parents would say, you can't leave the table until you clean your plate and there are children starving in India and all of that. And we didn't see the kind of weight problems that we see today. I don't know if parents are still saying that to their kids, but something has changed.
When we were growing up, right, we used to eat at meals. We didn't snack all the time. There wasn't food available on every corner. It wasn't that we were eating 24/7. And, you know, the food certainly wasn't as layered and loaded with fat on sugar and fat. You didn't go into a restaurant and have buffalo wings, which is the, you know, the fatty part of the chicken. Then it was sometimes double fried, added to that the sources of fat and sugar and then other sources. I mean, that's become ubiquitous over the last several decades. It's increasing the accessibility and also the social norms. It's okay to eat anytime. If I started eating a sandwich right here in the studio, you would be concerned to make a little noise, but it would socially, it's okay to eat anytime.
Didn't you go to London recently to talk with executives at a large global food company?
I did.
Do you find that companies that serve people in other parts of the world are more sophisticated about this sort of thing? Are they more concerned about the role they may be playing in making people overweight?
I explained to them the neuroscience. I explained that if you take fat, sugar, and salt, and you put it on every corner, and you advertise it, and you add the emotional gloss of advertising, that activates our brains. And there was dead silence in the room. And one of the executives said, everything that has made us successful in the past is the problem. I think the industry wants, if it can figure out, how to do the right thing. I think that what we need to do is, because the food industry really has been able to create add the kind of emotional gloss, to the food, they make it very, very appealing. We need to be able to use their talents to control our eating.
A listener wants to know whether breastfeeding will reduce childhood obesity as opposed to giving baby formula to the child.
Absolutely. It's probably one of the greatest gifts you can give a child.
The book is called The End of Overeating, Taking Control of the Insatiable American Appetite, published by Rodale, and written by David A. Kessler, who served as commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration under George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton. He is a pediatrician and been the dean of the medical schools at Yale and also at the University of California, San Francisco. Thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
It's been a pleasure.